I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hello and welcome to the London Elections podcast in association with Little Atoms with me, Josh Nico. And in this episode, housing. I've got a great panel today, Martin Skinner. He's a micro-apartment developer, CEO of Inspired Asset Management and Inspired Homes. Heather Kennedy, who's an organiser of Hackney Renters Group Digs, which is part of the Radical Housing Network. And Ben Judah, who's a journalist and author of This Is London, which is about the migrants' experience of London. Thank you all for coming. First question to you all. I'd like to hear your worst housing horror story that you've experienced yourself or of people you know, or your worst housing horror stat for London. Heather.
I'm gonna go with a story. This was a woman that I was talking to at Soup Kitchen last week in Hackney, and a lot of people might find surprising is that around two-thirds of the people who are using soup kitchens in London now, certainly in the ones that we work with in Hackney, they're not people who are homeless, they're not people in temporary accommodation, they're people in the worst end of the private rented sector. And this woman was telling me about her property where she lived, that she rented from private landlord. She said it was barely big enough to put her bed into. She had to share a sink with five other people, and she had to share a toilet with eight other people. This was a Victorian property that had been knocked into, been compartmentalised and knocked into flats. These properties are very often the only kind of properties that people on housing benefit can claim. And she told me that her housing benefit, so what her private landlord is getting from the council, from the state, for this, you know, can't even really call it a bed sit, is the maximum that they can get, which is around £250 a week. And she commented to me, and they call me a benefit scrounger.
Ben.
For my new book, This Is London, in order to understand the migrant experience of living in this city, I went undercover as a Romanian labourer. And in order to sort of live their lives in the way they actually lived, I managed to live in a doss house in Barking. A doss house is a place where you have, in two rooms, 17 people living, kind of sharing beds. One person was hot bedding, sleeping there by day. Another guy was sleeping there by night. And this is utterly typical for the Eastern European labourers' experience of London, this sort of Dickensian squalor. And indeed, there's one study by the LSE that says that since 2004, migrants from poorer countries, 40% of them have been accommodated in London by an increase of person per room. So the reality of that is this sort of squalid conditions.
So I've seen quite a few different awful cases of people living in terrible conditions. I've bought an awful lot of properties at auction, so I've seen all sorts there. I've seen people living underneath external exposed staircases. I've seen 17 people living in a one-bedroom apartment. Lightening the tone a little bit, I noticed that someone was renting out tents online in existing properties the other day. So I think there is the biggest issue I see is with supply. And I think that's leading to a real affordability crisis. I think there needs to be some work on the regulations from a realistic perspective. We've got to look at ways that we can increase supply within the constraints of the existing supply chain for construction.
Heather, do you see the London housing crisis as primarily one of supply or of affordability or both?
I don't see it as a problem of supply. There are actually more homes per person in London than there ever has been, and that's proportionate to the current population. So I'm quite sceptical of this idea that we have a supply issue. What we need is a massive move towards housing redistribution, because of course what we have is at the upper end of housing we've got people. Second, third, fourth homes, homes left empty. We've got people who are wealthier living in very large properties with a lot of space that they're not using. Then at the opposite end of the housing market, we have people in the situations as Ben describes. So we do have a huge amount of housing. We have enough housing. We have more than enough housing per person, but it's not being distributed according to need. It's being distributed according to the amount of money that people can command in an increasingly unequal society.
Martin, is there any way the market can handle this redistribution?
I don't think you can force wealthier people living in very expensive parts of London to share their home with other people. I think the risk of pushing wealthier people out of the market is that you draw less investment into the market. I really do think it is a supply issue. And I think there are various different regulations that get in the way.
And what primarily would you...
I think space standards is primarily to blame. I think there are more efficient ways of producing housing. There are more efficient ways of using housing. And I don't think the regulations have evolved quickly enough.
Ben,
something I'm very interested in doing in almost every kind of policy issue is trying to look at it from a historical perspective. And I think there's way too much sort of presentism in the debate. We actually have very, very good statistics on the relative relationship between the prices of assets such as property and income going right back in this city and this country to the 18th century. And what we see is that houses, flats, any form of accommodation was pretty much constantly unaffordable to the majority of the population, apart from when capital was seriously disrupted following the First World War and its slow economic aftermath up until the 1970s. And if the London of today is more or less normal, and one of the reasons behind this is that in the economic system as it currently is, kind of growth of capital and the increase of the value of capital almost always exceeds the growth of incomes. And slowly that manifests itself because property is an asset class in the sort of takeoff of property prices. I do, however, think that the rate of that increase can be very affected by issues of supply and also by issues of foreign money laundering in the London property market.
Heather, what would you say to Ben's sense that this is actually we're back in business as normal now?
I think that we've seen, certainly from the post-war period, and obviously Ben was reflecting on a much larger timescale, but I think if we look at how our housing, how the way that we house people, the way that we meet housing need and how that has changed in the last kind of 50, 60 years, then we do see people being pushed into worse and worse housing conditions. People are less able to afford decent, affordable housing. And I think that most people would agree that the kind of the slum conditions that we had in the Victorian era and then around the kind of Depression isn't the sort of place that we want to go back to. If we, I think what, rather than comparing ourselves with, you know, some of the very dire housing conditions that we had 100 years ago, then I think it might be more helpful to look at some of the other European countries who are a lot better at housing people and meeting housing need than we are. Of course, there's always been, you know, ebb and flow of people moving in and out of London, but very starkly now we are having people on low and middle incomes who can't afford to live here anymore.
Ben and Martin, how comparable is the UK to European cities and the markets there?
One of the comparable facts is that asset prices after the First World War, the Depression and the Second World War reached historically unprecedented lows. And all across Europe, you know, outside of the socialist bloc, the price of housing was at a historical low relative to income, allowing in Britain, France and Germany and Italy a larger percentage of the population than ever before to purchase property. And that to a varying degree of incline in all of those countries, you've had a reversion back to the historical norm of asset prices relationship to the average income, of which house prices are part. And obviously there are big differences between sort of London, Paris and Berlin, but there are a lot more similarities in the upward curve, I think, than we often would sort of take for granted.
Is there a distinction between the home ownership culture of the UK and a greater embrace of renting in continental Europe? Has that led to...
Well, there's one of the key aspects in this is that the relationship between kind of tenant and owner can have various different power dynamics. You can have a legal framework which gives the tenant far greater power, so they can effectively be there for life, they can have rent controls, or you can have a relationship where the owner has almost complete influence over this. And one thing we see is that Germany and Britain are at opposite ends of the scale on this.
I would say there are quite significant differences between the UK market and, for example, Germany. We have approximately twice the birth rate of Germany. We have a much higher rate of net migration into the country. And in particular, you know, people tend to move towards the strongest economic centre, and that's London. So I don't think we can really compare directly the rent-controlled market in Germany with what is perceived to be an unregulated space in the UK. But actually, there are some 430 regulations, roughly, that do apply to private landlords in the UK. So it's far from unregulated. I was at a do this morning where an investor that manages some 50 billion of investments and intends to put in 30% of their capital into what they now call social infrastructure, which includes housing. They said that the biggest risk to them investing in that sector would be rent control. If rent controls came in, their assets would be massively impaired, so they would have to look to exit that market. So I think it's very easy to say rents are going up too fast. I would agree completely. But actually some of that is as a result of kind of attacks on buy-to-let private landlords and private investors. If rent controls were brought into control rents, you have unintended consequences, which is typically that you have much higher rental inflation when the rent control is forced to be released.
Heather, the mayor's powers over rents are limited, and the candidates have suggested various things that would try to dampen down on rents or to regulate landlords more. But how do you feel about Martin's suggestion that rent control would have this deleterious effect?
Well, I mean, first of all, on the question of regulation, it's widely acknowledged that this is one of the most unregulated private rental sector markets. I don't think the individual pieces of regulation really gives us a helpful understanding of where we are. There was massive deregulation, of course, in the 1988 Housing Act, and we used to have fair rents. We used to have, you know, a form of rent control. We used to have much longer tenancies. And I would say that it was a healthier private rented sector in lots of ways. Obviously, the world is a different place, but I think we've actually got there's an awful lot of propaganda. Unexamined propaganda that goes against the idea of any form of rent control. And of course, there are many different ways that you can introduce a form of rent stabilisation. And of course, we would need to look at one that was workable within our current housing market. But what we hear all the time is that landlords would flee the market, so that would decrease supply. Well, that might create an immediate issue, but what, those houses are not going to somehow take off into space. I think one of the things that the government are trying to do with increasing tax on buy-to-let landlords is they are trying to go back on the real push towards encouraging people to become buy-to-let landlords, which they are now acknowledging, I would suggest, in the change of taxation, is actually strangling supply. So Martin talks about, you know, the problems around supply, the problems around people getting on the housing market. You know, we've had an absolute boom in the last few decades of buy-to-let landlords. So I really refute this idea that rent control needs to be discluded from the debate and the conversation because all of a sudden it would lead to a decrease in supply. I don't really think that bears up to that much analysis.
Martin, has the government gone too far with its tax changes on buy-to-let? Will we see a shortage of landlords?
Well, they haven't pushed buy-to-let out of the market entirely. But there seems to be this assumption that if you discourage a buy-to-let landlord then from buying a property, then you gain a home for a first-time buyer. It's not that simple. As a developer, you require a number of people to commit to purchasing units and to exchange units before you can draw the finance that you need to build them. Now, that process of building a scheme takes more than 6 months. It takes typically 12 to 18 months. So you won't get owner-occupiers committing to purchasing a unit outside the period that a mortgage offer is valid for, which is typically a maximum of 6 months. So if you put buy-to-let investors and foreign investors off buying to let, you actually lose potentially the entirety of the supply for both the owner-occupiers and the buy-to-let investors that would be purchasing those units. So I think you've got to be very careful with that sort of thing. And they're not far off putting buy-to-let investors off entirely. And I think there is an assumption that large-scale institutional investors will come in and fill that gap. And I really don't believe that that's the case. The economics of PRS, which is this idea of institutional professional rented sector, is going to come in, but the economic model doesn't quite work. You don't get the same value from a rental-based valuation with standard size units. You can do it. There is a precedent out there. Student housing has worked very effectively with smaller private spaces and larger shared spaces. However, currently you have to rent those to students. So the 20 to 40 sort of age group up until the first-time buyer age is unserved. I think the government could enable that market to really happen very professionally if they removed the requirement to rent student apartments to students. Then they could be produced and rented to young professionals, and they would be much more affordable.
Ben, tell me about the role of foreign investment in London and the extent to which it's a boon or a pressure on the city.
Well, I'd like to talk about something a little more precise than that, which is the role that money laundering plays in the London property market. On paper, Britain has a very tough anti-money laundering sort of set of legislation, but legislation only exists as far as it is enforced. One thing that we have seen over the sort of last 20 years with the entry into the global financial system of China and Russia and other former sort of communist states is a rapid rise in corrupt individuals in those countries with dirty black cash pilfered from their national budgets, seeking to launder it into nice white cash that can then buy sort of beautiful sort of consumer objects and sort of Ferraris and rings or whatever in the West. This is a huge part of the global economy, which is little discussed. Every year, around $1 trillion leaves poorer countries and travels towards the West. The way it does this is via a sort of parallel financial system, which permits individuals to enter a sort of dark web of finance where their identities can be completely concealed. The first step towards achieving this is to create a shell company which hides your identity. A project recently called the Global Shell Games so contacted 3,000 incorporation agents worldwide. They found a quarter of them were willing to set up a shell company with no proof of identity, and half of them were willing to to set up a shell company with only flimsy sort of proofs of identity, such as sort of an incomplete set of documents. A shell company is not actually a company. A shell company is a company stripped to its sort of barest sort of legal definition. It produces no goods and services. And in fact, what it is almost like a code that you can't crack to identify the owner of a certain sort of sum of cash. And most of them are actually designed by computers, so you have an endless chain of holding companies. These are registered typically in British tax havens. British tax havens take around a third of the 17 trillion worldwide in this parallel financial system. And then one of these shell companies can then purchase a London property. So what that creates is a funnel of anonymity, which is legally, of course, possible in a way that wouldn't be possible to a sort of British citizen, in order to turn dirty black cash into nice white cash in the London property market. And according to the National Crime Agency, hundreds of billions are laundered in the London property market every year, and this has distorted the market.
And the distortion, does that feed through the whole market, or is it basically confined to these super prime properties that we see?
I think the way that property pricing actually works, and the way that it is to a certain extent indexed, and the way that, you know, the relationship of different.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, everyone. I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently. Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Kind of agents and price reflexes. Yes, it does. But I think it hasn't filtered through to the rest of the country to quite the same degree. It's always a question of degrees here. So prices in London over the last 20 years have risen by 501%. In the rest of the country, it's a 300%. I do believe a part of that is through money laundering. I went out of my way to sort of prove that my sort of funnel of financial flows isn't sort of merely a sort of very intellectual argument, but is actually happening on a daily basis. And for a TV show called From Russia with Cash, I was the creative consultant and came up with the idea for this show. A Russian activist from the Russian opposition pretended to be a corrupt government minister, and we sort of went into five sort of household names, sort of fine estate agents in Kensington and Chelsea, and he sort of went in, viewed five sumptuous properties, and said, "Hello, I've stolen this money from the Russian budget. I'm a minister. Will you sell me this house?" And behaving like the Swiss bankers of 20 years ago, the state agents were all ready to proceed and were all recommending that he set up this scheme. So my kind of policy recommendation for the next mayor would be to end the ability to buy property anonymously in London. In an age where the average citizen feels he's under surveillance, the government's taking more and more, and companies taking more and more of their privacy away, I think it's quite shocking that we do not know who owns 37,000 properties in London. That's a total area of 2.25 square miles. I think that's deeply troubling, given this sort of these patterns of money laundering at play. In terms of laws not being enforced, not only were the estate agents sort of behaving very poorly in my show, they also effectively don't file what are called suspicious activity reports. There are two crimes in this country where you're supposed to immediately report suspicion of it to the authorities. One is terrorism. If I go, I feel like sort of blowing myself up on the tube, you've got to immediately report me. That's just what you've got to do. And if I also went to you, hello, I'm thinking of engaging in some money laundering, you would have to immediately report me as well. Estate agents only filed 0.05% of suspicious activity reports in the United Kingdom last year, which is way out of proportion. Remember, the National Crime Agency says hundreds of billions are being laundered in London every year to their exposure to this this nefarious thing. And I think one of the policy proposals I'd have to answer that, which is that we need to make a lot more of these laws real by having them actually enforced. And you need to have serious fines. You need to have people struck off the register if it's found that that they have been doing dealings with flagrantly corrupt sort of kleptocrats.
Heather, in terms of legal enforcement or new laws in the area of property generally, what would you most like to see the next mayor propose?
I think, to be honest, it's fairly limited in what can be imposed just by the mayor speaking directly about the private rented sector. So what we need in the private rented sector, and these two policies would need to go hand in hand, is that we need security of tenure and we need some form of workable rent stabilisation. This is what is being explored in Scotland, and this is what looks like it will be introduced. So we need to follow suit, but that's not something that the London Mayor could introduce. Where I feel that the London Mayor has a real role is around the flow of wealthy investment money coming into the city. So I think we saw under Boris Johnson him at pains really to encourage foreign investment money. He really is an idea that Martin alluded to, this idea that this kind of investment trickles down and is of benefit to individuals. I think we've seen the exact opposite. In fact, I think this foreign investment money has flowed right down to the market. It's pushed up people's rents and it's priced people out. So it's actually been negative to people on lower middle incomes. And I would really like to see the next mayor send a very clear message that London is not for sale. I would like them to work with central government to scrap this concept of affordable housing, which is almost this kind of Orwellian idea where you have something that's called affordable and in fact it's anything but. And we would like them to place a much higher minimum requirement on developers to provide not affordable in quotation marks but social housing.
Should we, at this time that we see the number of renters about to overtake the number of owner occupiers in London, should the aspiration to own property, which the Conservatives nationally and Zach Goldsmith embrace, is this something that it should still be an aim in the second decade of the 21st century? Is something for everybody?
Yeah, I think it's a good aspiration for people to have. Certainly buying my
first
home.
Even when it's a painful dream.
Good things are often difficult to get. it's never been easy to buy the first home. I think it's a real stretch. It was a big stretch for me. But it's one of the best things that I've ever done. I think the government's help for first-time buyers with the help to buy is a great thing. It's definitely helped a lot of people to get onto the ladder. But I think it shouldn't be at the expense of buy-to-let landlords, for example, because they produce most of the rental stock that people are renting, whether they're bought by buy-to-let investors in the UK or abroad. Investors from abroad don't buy properties and then leave them empty. They tend to rent them out, so local people tend to occupy them. I think the government should be encouraging investment across the board, and it should be reducing regulation to enable an increase in supply. It's clearly a supply issue for me. We had a housing crisis before the credit crunch. We've been producing half as many homes as we need for as long as I can remember. But I don't think it's rocket science to solve this. We have a construction capacity constraint. We're producing half as many homes as we need. people don't want the responsibility, in my experience, having had thousands of tenants. They don't want the responsibility of more space privately than they need. And they don't want the responsibility of longer-term contracts. I don't remember anyone asking me for a longer contract. They typically pay a premium for shorter contracts. How about we make the units significantly smaller, but we have student-style social spaces that are more conducive to actually creating community?
Ben, your thoughts on the future of home ownership?
Well, the historical pattern would be is that because the sort of rate of return and the rising value of capital almost always outside of a period of war or political chaos exceeds the increase in income, I think we will see, especially through the inheritance mechanism, with people people who've already got capital, inheriting capital from their parents, leading to an accumulation of their capital, we will see a growing concentration of rates of possession within a smaller band of the population. And I think short of very radically different politics and sort of confiscatory taxes, that's something people are going to have to learn to live with. I feel actually quite pessimistic about the possibilities of politics in this current period.
Heather, what do you think about home ownership as a continuing aspiration for Londoners?
Well, we can talk about home ownership as a continuing aspiration, as indeed I think the current government are interested in doing. That doesn't tell us anything about how realistic that aspiration is for people. It's that part that I'm interested in. And we know that actually that aspiration is becoming more and more unrealistic. That's why we've got such a steep decline in the number of people who are able to afford their own home. Help to buy, I think, is making things worse. It's pushing up house prices. It's also only available to wealthier people. And I think that there has always been, and there will always be, a section of our society. It's much larger now. You know, you've got people on really quite comfortable incomes who still can't afford to buy. But you will always have a section of our society that will not be able to afford to buy their own property. This government has no policies and apparently no interest in how those people will be housed. The Housing and Planning Bill will make everything worse, particularly for the future of social housing in London. I think this bill will really ring the death knell for that. Essentially, it's requiring poorer people, local councils to sell the housing for poorer people to subsidise housing for wealthier people so they can get on the housing ladder. Now that's just incredibly unprogressive, and it will wreak devastation, and it will make the housing crisis much worse. I think we hear it from all quarters, actually, from the left and the right, that there needs to be an increase in affordable housing. But what does that really mean? What we need is an increase in council housing. Martin suggests that we can address the housing shortage by student size, social spaces. Well, the problem with that, Martin, is that we have a large part of the increase of private renters is families. It's not students. It's not even young professionals. It's families who are already being asked to bring up their children in a space that is completely inappropriate. There will always be people who for whom, such as families, disabled people, older people, people for whom the private rented sector is not an appropriate place to live. It doesn't offer the right level of stability or protection from exploitation. We are always going to need council housing. What really worries me about the Housing and Planning Bill is that once we see the mass sale of homes and communities under this bill, then we're not going to get those homes and communities back.
Martin, apart from the economics, isn't there a case for mixed communities in London?
Of course, yeah. I think there is a major problem in social housing. I don't think the private rented sector can be blamed for it. I think local authorities should be doing an awful lot more of social house building, social home building. You know, it shouldn't just automatically be dumped onto private developers to develop social housing. It should be a government-led rollout.
I mean, and I agree with that, Martin. So what we need is we need to lift the borrowing caps, which currently stop local councils from building social housing. That's one of the first things that the central government should do.
I agree. I think I personally feel that across the board there is a bit of a policy gap here. There have been huge cutbacks in social housing grants. There have been attacks on private rented sector landlords from a taxation perspective, and there haven't really been any new ideas in terms of supply, aside from the deregulation of office to residential.
And how do you feel about estate regeneration as a policy, which Zach Goldsmith is more enthusiastic about than Sadiq Khan? Is it an important way of giving local authorities more funds to ensure that social housing is in better condition, or is this a way of undermining communities?
We've seen some communities across London hugely undermined by some very, very unfortunate state-led models of essentially gentrification. It's only redevelopment if there is a benefit to that community, and that has not been the policy intention in estates like the Haygate estate, equally in the area that I live in Hackney Downs. So I think we have to be really, really careful here. People have really been burned, and they've been priced out of their communities. Of course, local authorities are really struggling to do what they can to fund regeneration. But what we've seen too many times is that the argument is made, oh, well, these estates are sink estates, it's poor housing. But actually, there's been a very deliberate policy on the part of local councils to pull funding and to allow these estates to fall into a state of disrepair so they can justify selling off council housing and replacing it with housing that is going to make them a lot more money.
Martin, you an enthusiast for estate regeneration, particularly perhaps to increase densities in parts of London?
I'm in favour of increasing densities. I'm not really in favour of moving existing populations out of areas that they've grown up in.
Final question. Is consultation with communities, have we seen enough by developers and by local authorities over the last decade? How can we ensure that this consultation happens better in future?
Look, there's a balance with this. There are lots of very well-intentioned policies, and I think local authorities tend to be very populist, so they try very hard to give everybody their say. People will tend to have a NIMBY culture. They tend to be biased against development. Without development, you don't get supply, however. And the longer it takes to get planning consents and to build schemes out, the more expensive it is for developers and the more you come across a viability issue. You know, in general, I think there are something like 300,000 units worth of consented schemes in London. My experience is not that developers don't want to build them out and collect their profits. They do. It's just that when they get a consent, it's based on a viability assessment, which will typically allow about a 20% margin on cost. Now, my funding costs me a lot more than this, but let's say you assume it's 10% per annum. If it takes a year and a half to get your consent, and many take an awful lot longer than that, and it takes you 18 months to build it out, well, that's 30%. It doesn't work. And that's why most schemes end up sat there to a degree, waiting for house price inflation or for their Section 106 agreements to be negotiated. So I think we have a viability issue for most new schemes, and I think that's due to a lot of wasted time with inefficiencies in the planning process.
Do you accept that explanation, Heather?
No, I mean, what I would say about consultation is that it's it's almost become a bit of a dirty word because from the perspective of communities, it's been done in a way where the intention was never genuine. The desire to meaningfully consult with residents was just never there. And I've spoken to countless architects who have said that they've been privy to development plans that long before they've ever gone to consultation. The developers and the councils have been very, very clear about what direction they're going in, and the role here for local communities to be able to resist regeneration that isn't going to be of benefit to that community has been watered down to such a degree. And I mean, I'll give you one example. One of the worst examples I've ever seen is in Barnet Council. Very, very good quality housing on the Sweetsway estate. All of that property is still, I think it's still sitting absolutely empty, and it's been empty for a really long time. While those families have been moved out of borough, they've been moved to much less suitable conditions for people who were bringing up families. You know, I spoke to one lad who'd lived on the estate his whole life. He was 16, he was doing his GCSEs. It took him two and a half hours to get to school every day. And those homes are sitting empty, waiting for them to be bulldozed and replaced with luxury flats.
A greater accountability for local authorities in that case, and for the mayor to take an active position on that.
Yeah, I think local authorities need to be given more powers, because I think sometimes when local authorities do try to act in the interests of residents and do try to stand up to developers, then they find that actually their hands are tied and they have very little power. So I would like to see a redressing of the balance of power between local authorities and developers in these kind of development plans.
I disagree on the basis that I think we need to find more efficient ways of producing housing in order to keep up with the demand. And I really don't think that local authorities are the most efficient people to deal with that. My experience is that, for the most part, they tend to be on holiday or ill or changing or coming up with a new strategy to get a solution to a problem to produce a development. It's very difficult, and it's called development control. Okay, I really think this should be seen much more as a development facilitation process. There's no question that we need more homes, we need more amenities, we need more community facilities. Without development, you don't get any of those things, and the existing stock just deteriorates.
On Peron Lincoln Councils.
I think that you know that there is this argument, which is very popular, that local authorities are overly bureaucratic and not efficient. And, you know, obviously to some extent that is correct. But you compare them to many private developers, and actually the outcomes for normal people, for people who just want somewhere to live, are far greater when the housing is being provided by local authorities, for the simple reason that there isn't the same profit motive there. And we've seen what this ideology, which has been embraced by successive governments, that the private sector can provide and meet housing need. We've seen the failure of that in the current London housing crisis.
We'll have to stop it there. Thank you very much to you all, to Heather, to Ben, to Martin. Please tune in to the next episode.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.